Good morning, and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Jack Brighton is our producer, and Brian Wagner is at the controls this morning. In this second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the experiences of poor women in America. And our guest for the show is the author of a book that attempts to give these women and young girls, the opportunity to talk about their experiences in their own voice, in a sense to say who they are. So much of the dialogue around poverty and social programs in this country is conducted by policy people, academics, politicians, and so seldom do we hear from those who are directly affected by the policies that are being debated. And I think that the intent of the book that we will be talking about in this part of Focus is to remedy that to some extent. Our guest for the show is Lisa Dodson. She is Principal Investigator of Welfare in Transition, which is a collaborative research project of Radcliffe College and also the cities of Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts. She is a fellow at the Radcliffe Public Policy Institute. She also teaches at Harvard University, teaches on issues of women and poverty. And the book is titled Don't Call Us Out of Name. The subtitle is The Untold Lives of Women and Girls in Poor America. It's published by The Beacon Press, which is a publisher out of Boston. Lisa Dodson's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, comments, questions from people listening are welcome. All we ask of callers is that they are brief so that we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But anybody who is listening is invited to join the conversation with questions or comments. The number to call, if you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333 WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Dodson, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Absolutely, glad to be here.
The title I gather for people who might find it a little bit confusing is, I guess, another way of saying don't tell me who I am. Is that kind of it?
That's right. That's very much the point of the title. It actually came out of a moment in doing this research when I heard a woman use that phrase. She used the phrase, don't call me out of name, and she specifically meant don't call me a welfare recipient or don't call me an unfit mother or a bunch of the other names that have long been associated with women who are poor raising children in this country. And it kind of captured what I realized I'd heard from hundreds of women and girls, so it became the title.
Yeah, and it does certainly seem to be the case that an awful lot of the people who are not only commenting on social policy that affects the disadvantaged, but helping to shape that policy have little or no contact with the people that it's intended to help.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I actually think it's kind of an extraordinary gap between who's making the decisions and who's living them out. There's always, of course, a gap, but I think that if we give some thought to who the people are who are in positions of authority around these kind of major public policy, family policy issues, it's very unlikely that they've had extensive or perhaps any contact whatsoever with what it's like to be largely single, not only single mothers, but largely single mother, who's living poor and who's coping with usually one or two children and just trying to manage all that means living in this land. It's such a tremendous divide of experience. And part of the point of my book was not really to unpackage all of public policy and welfare policy, but to kind of get at how far apart these lives are and to, in a sense, call for the inclusion of people who live the life in thinking about what's best for us as a nation.
Hmm. And I think, you know, overall, one of the impressions that I think I get, it goes to the kind of comment that actually I think that I've heard before from mm-hmm. people who are social workers mm-hmm. or in that kind of a role, that that while one might, on one hand, think that being poor would mean that you had a simple life mm-hmm. because of the constraints of your poverty, the fact that you didn't have a lot of the choices that maybe other people do, that's not at all true. That in fact, it is very complex because you have to, in a sense, sort of do the same sorts of things, but it becomes more complex and more difficult because of the constraints of poverty that's layered on top. So in a sense, instead of making your life easier because you have fewer choices, it makes it more difficult because it denies you some of the easy choices that having resources give you. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, a really simple example of that is getting your clothes cleaned. I mean, as basic as that, you know, because one of the things I tried to do in my research was spend time with women, just spend time. So I would walk with them and talk as they went about doing the things that they do. And I think it's kind of hard for most people who have built into their lives certain kinds of material opportunities and goods, such as laundries, a washing machine, and a dryer. It's hard to imagine how much time it would take to keep two children, say, age 4 and 7, their clothes clean if you not only don't have a laundry or a dryer in your apartment, but you don't have one in your building because the ones that were put in that building have broken long, long ago. So you go to whatever's the closest laundromat, and you don't own a car because very, very few people. Some people have access to cars. Occasionally, no one owns them. So this takes hours and hours of time, which you usually do with your children. And it's just that's just one. I mean, then there's, of course, food and getting your kids to and from school and getting to the doctor. It goes on and on. And that's not even bringing in the complexity of just managing all the public systems you've got to deal with, because in order to get housing or food or to get cash income such as welfare and many of the other kind of basic supports you need, you spend hours and hours of time pursuing them and waiting, just waiting in waiting rooms. And of course, all of that I just named is not considered work. That's considered non-work. Based on our public policies now, and those are people that have to be made to go to work. And I think any parent who's managed kids with very little resources would counter that it may not be paid work, but it's hard work to do all of that and to do it well.
Yeah. It certainly the poor people in this country have to deal with a lot of stereotyping, and one of the stereotypes we have of poor women, single moms, is that they're not very good parents.
That's right.
And I'm sure that there are cases of. We know there are cases of abuse and neglect, but you know, they're middle class people and upper class people. Some of them also abuse and neglect their children. So it's a kind of thing that cuts all across income levels. The thing that's again very striking, I think, about the women that you write about in this book is how hard they work, how much they worry, how concerned they are, and in a very traditional way. I mean, talk about your traditional family values, and how traditional ways they think about and dedicate themselves to their families.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the central role. Most of the women. You know, I'm talking about African-American women, Latinas, white women, all of them. Their kind of central identity and role had to do with their family. And by that I mean certainly first and foremost their children, but also their siblings, their parents, perhaps their nieces and nephews that their, say, older sister has asked them to help with. This is really partly because you spend so much time if you don't have money to purchase any services or any help. You spend so much time doing it, it just inevitably, as we all know, the work we do has a great deal to do with how we identify ourselves. And this is very much how people identify themselves, and women I'm talking about. And therefore, in many ways, it does really sort of, to some of us, seem like hearkening back to a more kind of traditional structure of family. Of course, the problem is that you're doing all of that when you're a poor woman against the stigma of being told in 100 different ways that you are doing nothing, that you were doing, that you are a bad parent, just as you mentioned earlier, and that you need to be made through public policies to do better. And I'm not, certainly not suggesting that there aren't many women, particularly women who've become extremely depressed and who have despaired, who in fact don't need, that they have real problems parenting and keeping their families together. But from my experience, that's the minority. We just don't hear about the majority. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lisa Dodson. She is...
Fabiana, come on up for the check.
Little child issue there.
Yes.
Okay. She is currently principal investigator of Welfare in Transition, a collaborative research project of Radcliffe College and the cities of Cambridge and Boston. She is a policy fellow at the Radcliffe Public Policy Institute. She also teaches at Harvard. Her book, the one that we mentioned here, is titled Don't Call Us Out of Name, The Untold Lives of Women and Girls in Poor America, published by the Beacon Press. Questions, of course, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think it's interesting that, going back to this point about how much, how important families are to the women that you have talked to and how much time and energy they invest in taking care of families. And it's interesting that you really begin the book, the substance of the book, is with a conversation with women about the experiences of really young girls and young women mm-hmm. who have at sometimes fairly early age had parenting and family responsibilities thrust upon them.
That's
and
right.
That helps to, perhaps inculcate in them this idea that that's, for a woman, this is extremely, I hesitate to say the most important thing, but an extremely important role.
That's, right.
That's what women are, the women are there. Their job is to take care of people, that not only to take care of their children, but essentially that, to take care of everybody.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the role that you're in, you're encultured into. If I think in general, obviously there's a tremendous gender experience in families, but I think that that when you're part of an extended family that is living poor and really struggling to survive, that role is extremely important, and it starts very, very young.
Hmm. There's also, one of the things that we seem to have to get to pretty quick in these kinds of conversations is why it is we seem to have the level of single motherhood that we have,
mm-hmm.
and all kinds of questions asked about why it is that happens, what's going on in the heads of girls who are getting pregnant, what sort of complications do the policy introduce. We still, even now in this age that we have so drastically changed the kind of supports that are available to mm-hmm. single women with the children, we're still hearing stuff from people saying, well, it's because these young women have gotten the idea that the government will support them
yeah.
and their children.
Yeah.
And it's, we're definitely getting way past the point that was true, even if that was ever true.
Yeah.
Did you, particularly talking with young girls, with
yeah.
teenage girls, did you get some sense of what they're thinking about in terms of their relationships with boyfriends, and what's the meaning of sex, and what's the meaning of having children, and how that all interacts with the world in which they live?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I think that what I noticed was that that of course the kind of curiosity and interest in becoming a woman. That goes on for young women who are growing up poor in America is in many ways just the same as it is for all of us, young men and young women everywhere. There's a lot of curiosity and interest in the opposite sex, and that kind of comes particularly in young adolescents and then grows up. But I think that one of the central differences for these young women is that very few of them had the idea that at the point that they finished school, if they did finish high school, they then had a path to go someplace else, i.e. college, or that both post-secondary school was at all feasible for them and therefore could lead them to a job that would be, a reasonably well-paid job. That was not the sense they had. In fact, a lot of them have been spending most of their time, including time not putting into homework and any kind of extracurricular activities like sports or culture, different kind of cultural opportunities, art, dancing. Most of these young girls were going to school and then heading home to do house chores or to take care of siblings. Or to pick up where parents would be racing out the door, or there simply wouldn't be a very strong parent structure there to begin with. And they very much saw the next steps of their lives, precisely because of that, as being themselves parents. They knew how to do it. They were, as numerous young women have said to me, I knew how to take care of a baby by the time I was 10 years old. I was left alone with my baby brother, and I'd take care of him all day. This is not a sort of new or, in a sense, risky endeavor for them. On the other hand, I've never talked to a young woman who said that she had a baby because she thought she would get welfare. They have babies for the same reason I think most young women get involved with guys and then become sexually active. They long for boyfriends. Boyfriends are very much seen as kind of the next step in life, getting away from all these obligations and family. You don't think you're going to college. And the fact is, they're right. They're not going to college. I mean, very, very few of the young women I've talked to or the women I've talked to as older women had families that could possibly support that. And a lot of them went to schools where they were ill-prepared. Some schools didn't even organize SAT taking in their senior years. So boyfriends really were seen as kind of the next stage of life. And I think the other really significant difference, and this is well documented in studies and national studies, is that young women who are low income are much less likely to decide to terminate a pregnancy than are middle class young women. So there you go. The steps sort of lead you to the place where you have a birth control accident. Almost all the young women were using it, but they weren't using it perfectly, which is fairly typical for youngsters. And then they would get pregnant, and very, very few anymore will decide to terminate, to have an abortion. And so their mothers.
So would it be correct to say that the only real significant, well, okay, maybe that, maybe I should back off that. Among the significant differences between these teenagers and other kids who come from more advantaged circumstances is the fact that the kids who have the advantages have more they have more things that they want to do or that they believe that they can do, and that there's this big mix of stuff, and it's a matter of where you set your priorities. And if you think that you're going to go to college, you're going to have a career, yes, someday maybe you want to have a family. Obviously, you want to have close relationships. But if you cut the other stuff out, and these kids, the kids that you had the opportunity to talk to, if they see that they have fewer options, well, then, they're going to do what's left, which is the same stuff everybody else wants to do, and yet we tend to, the more advantaged kids put that off, say, well, I'm going to do that someday. But if you don't have the other stuff, then that's going to rise right to the top of the list of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that, first of all, we do know from national studies, particularly the Guttmacher Institute, which basically they follow teen pregnancy and teen sexual experience, and we know most kids in this country, by the time they're graduating high school, are sexually active. I mean, that's just across the board. That's true. Data seems to suggest that middle-income and more advantaged kids use birth control somewhat better than lower-income kids, although they raise the question, researchers have done work on this, raise the question that it might be simply an access issue as well. But what is really outstanding difference is the fact that low-income girls who become pregnant in their teens, and the vast majority of teens who become pregnant are 17 and 18 and 19. They're not, the 15 and 14 year old thing we get a lot of publicity about, but that is a tiny, tiny percentage, like less than 5% of teen pregnancies. the big difference is, it seems as though the young women who are low income choose to go ahead and start the role of mother versus terminating the pregnancy and becoming a mother later on in life, because later on is a very different time if you're graduating from a suburban school and your parents are fairly well-to-do and you know you're going to college. Later on, when you're 25, life will be very, very different if you choose to have a child at that point. The fact is that other work that's been done, some wonderful studies have been done that have followed sisters who, one of whom became, had a baby when she was a teen, and then her older sister who waited till she was her 20s. And these young, these studies followed women who were poor to begin with. And the fact was that when they were both 35, they were still poor, whether they had the baby at 18 or at 24. The problem is we're not investing enough into the feasible options, real options for young girls and young boys, so that they can make the same kinds of decisions, weighing real options. Well, if I do this, and if I give up this, and if I don't work hard at this, I'm going to lose these things that are real for me. I'm going to have them, or I'm going to lose them. But for kids who are poor in America, those are not real options.
So what, though, makes the difference between the experiences? Because there are some young women who they've gotten pregnant, they've had babies, mm-hmm. but then have also managed to continue to go to school,
yes.
to get themselves to college, to
That's
get themselves,
right.
I mean, to really
yes.
climb up the ladder,
right.
And to better their circumstances for themselves and their children. I mean, what
yes.
really makes the difference between being able to do that and not being able to
yeah.
do that?
Well, you know, if you think about middle-class kids, you can think about in a family of different kids, and some kids just do better than others. I mean, we tend to think that when we're talking about low-income kids, there's like these sort of broad categories, and you're in one category, you're in the other. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, for all people, there's really a distribution of how well you do, even when you have privileges. So that's one part of it. People are different, and some people do better under hardship than others, and some people do better in privilege than others. I think another issue is very much to do with what do we do with this young woman at the point that she's, you know, 17 years old or 18 years old and she's a baby. And that is, by we, I mean her family, her own family, but also the schools and other adults who have an obligation, in my opinion, certainly, to the youth that is coming up. And we certainly see that in situations where young girls themselves have some determination, and very often the vast majority of young girls, young women who have a baby, they describe all of their decisions around the future of that child. That's like the pivot point of everything. A lot of them have some determination. Sometimes it's varying, and it isn't always, you know, they're young, and they don't always, they aren't always steady with it. But overall, most of them have some determination. If there are opportunities for them, if the school helps them, if there's realistic child care, if their family is able to help them, in other words, mom and older sister aren't themselves at work, you know, 60 hours a week at low-wage jobs, they have to work a job and a half. So if there's a family available to help, and if we have programs and schools available to help, you know, we know for a fact many, many, many young women have grown into, have, in fact, graduated, many of them with their class cohort. That's particularly true with African-American young women. They tend to do better and graduate sooner while raising children than do white or Latinas. And they go on, you know, maybe not, you don't go right into a four-year college. That's just, you know, they tend to take 10, 15 years to get their bachelor's degree. But a lot of these people do keep trying. I think what's on the rest of society is to make that ladder more possible, particularly for someone who's carrying a baby up the ladder with her. And if we want her to get up, we don't want her to fall or drop her child on the way, then we have to make it more reasonable. We have to give her some support.
The caller here is in Aurora on line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I guess this is a problem in America, and mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you're addressing it, especially in a book, and hope
Thank
that
you.
It is spread widely mm-hmm. in America and otherwise, across every place, I uh-huh. suppose. I have an elderly mother that I need care for.
Yeah.
So I had caretakers come in.
Yeah.
And I was just saddened, shocked, I don't know what adjective to use, yes. to hear the stories these women told. They evidently had been on welfare
yeah.
and had been given this job of going into the home and doing some
caretaking.
Work.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, and I don't know how to say it.
Uh-huh.
It's so shocking.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe how many of them had almost been killed by their husbands.
Yeah.
It's a shocking, shocking thing.
Yeah, the domestic violence, yeah.
What?
The domestic violence that they've had.
It was shocking.
Yeah.
And then I began to think about it.
Yeah.
And I thought of other friends I know that had been, and I added up my list of people women that I know that have been almost killed by their husbands, and the post-traumatic syndrome
yes,
that they
yeah.
go through after it, that is so hard if they ever get over it.
Yes.
And that's, I don't hear that spoken about.
Yes.
Maybe men ruling the world don't want to talk about it, you know?
Yep.
But I had in a space of like from March to August, I had 13 women come into my house, so I had a good
sample there. Yeah, you sure did.
A sample there.
Yeah.
One woman said her brother-in-law and her husband had tried to kill her.
Oh, God.
And I told her to go get help, but I could see I was getting nowhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just
yeah.
can't. And the other thing that I think is so shocking in America is that men don't pay support for their children, and I wonder why they don't have to support these children that they bring into the world. I don't think it's a universal thing in America.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very good point. I think that one response to what, well, I want to respond to both things you're saying. I think that this caller who's bringing up the issue of domestic violence is just, it's a critical part of the whole picture.
It's epidemic.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. And it cuts, you know, cross race, it's throughout the country. And I think that the difference for a woman who has no resources, that is money, to get away from a domestic violence situation, it's hard enough for anybody to do.
Has happened in my own family.
Yes, I'm sure it's happened in many of our families. It's just people don't talk about it. But I think that
you think we ought to, because everybody's so shamed by this.
Yes.
And you talk about it, and then it becomes an issue. And if it becomes an issue, maybe it could be solved, or something could be done about it. That other women would say, well, she's talking about it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll tell her what happened to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most, the only reason why the issue of domestic violence has begun to get some recognition has been because women have come out. And all kinds of women from all walks of life have come out and said that this has happened to me. And I think it's very important for poor women, because poor women face the double whammy of not only having the domestic violence situation, but they don't have a way to support their children and themselves if they choose to get away from a batterer. And it makes it extremely hard. I know a couple of women who told me that the day their child left home, they walked out. But they didn't walk out till then.
Yeah, I guess I have a paper that tells that this clothesline project, have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's a project, and it's out of Orland Park,
uh-huh.
Illinois. And it tells about, it's a women display these shirts designed by women survivors of violence.
Wow.
And it tells about what color is for what type. White is for women who have been murdered.
Wow.
Blue or green for women survivors of sexual assault, childhood, yellow or beige for women survivors of assault or domestic violence, pink or red for women survivors of rape or sexual assault, purple shirts for women abused because of their sexual orientation.
Yep. Sounds wonderful.
I guess this isn't exactly what you're talking about, but I feel it's a part of women's lives, whether they're poor or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, absolutely, it is a part of all women's lives. I mean, the point I make in the book, and in fact, the majority of women who I've interviewed and talked with over the years, the majority of them have had one or another kind of the assaults that you just named in the Clothesline Project. And these have a tremendous impact on their ability to deal with all that they are supposed to deal with to become, to carry on their lives and to get jobs and to become, quote, independent. So it's part of the whole picture, and it's a really critical part of it. I really appreciate your bringing it up.
Well, one of the women told me that she, beautiful woman, came, and I asked her as we started to talk, I said, what are you going to do with your life? Because I could see that this was not her kind of work. She says, I am going to be an X-ray technician. I'm going in the fall to college. And I said, great. Well, then, of course, in the course of the conversation, the one day she was with me, she told me how she had this child out of wedlock. And when she said this to me, I became instantly, I was just, oh, I got so angry. She said, and I couldn't get over how my boyfriend got so mad because I was pregnant.
Yeah.
So I said, well, what did that tell you?
Yes, right.
And he left it.
Yeah.
And I suppose, as you said, these women do become pregnant, and it just taxes their whole life.
Absolutely.
And for the next 20 years, till this child, as you said, then the woman walks out of the house.
Yeah, that's right.
And I hate to tell, but I'm going to tell anyway. I've said this before. Some of the things that happen to women happen to very educated women. It isn't only the poor.
That's true.
Educated. And I think we have to keep that in mind, although I know the majority of women that this happens to are poor.
Yeah.
And they don't have the means or the family or the support for it. And I thank you again.
Thank you very much for calling.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on. We have someone here locally to talk with next in Urbana. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I believe I've read that young women are more likely to become pregnant as teenagers if they have been victims of sexual abuse.
Yes.
And that their partners are very likely to be older males rather than males of their same age.
That's right.
And I was reading, it's part of a book group I'm in, several years ago we were reading the book Obsidian Mirror, which is a woman's story of recovering from incest.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that really struck me, and I remember from that book, was the fact that she became promiscuous.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, when she became sexually mature,
yes,
I forget at what age.
Yep.
And it hit me that she had never been allowed to see herself as someone who could say no to sex.
Yeah.
And that her relationships with men, the men in her, and it was men in her family.
Yeah.
Grandfather.
Yeah.
And I forget who all else. It wasn't. It was like three or four males in her family. Varying relationships had abused her, and that was the way she had been taught to relate to men.
Yeah.
I don't think we're very, very, very judgmental of people who get pregnant in an unplanned way, and I think we really don't have any concept often of why this might happen, and I think that's one of the reasons. And the another thing that the previous caller touched on, and you did too, was about being able to get away from an abusive relationship. There was an editorial in our local newspaper about how the Clinton administration was proposing child care subsidies and how this is another governmental program.
Yeah.
And there's been back and forth letters to the editor about this. Well, some people saying, well, gee, why should I pay for somebody else to have child care? And
yeah.
To me it means that it's possible for a woman to be able to get a job outside the home and hold it, and it gives her not only some economic independence, but psychological independence.
Yes.
And it's not for us to figure out whether she's making the best choice in her life for herself and her children. It may very well be that what she's allowing herself to do is to have a way out if she's in a relationship that is abusive.
Yes.
And I think we really need to think about those things when we're making these judgments about other people's lives and what where we're willing to put our financial tax resources. I think we need to allow people more options.
Yeah, I really agree with you, and I agree with the previous caller that, I mean, one of the issues that you're both touching upon in somewhat different ways, but it's that the reality of women's lives, all perhaps women's lives, but certainly women who are in a position to be stigmatized and to be stereotyped, the reality of their lives, it's extremely hard to get that out to the public and to have people kind of respectfully listen and hear what it's really like to be managing, including managing past trauma that one may or may not have had any help for. And that was certainly in all the interviews and work I've done, experiencing past trauma was just the majority experience, not the minority experience of women. It's awfully hard to get the whole debate about women and poverty and welfare and all of that off the track it's on, where the people who are defining all the terms are entirely stereotyping millions and millions of very different women and making policies based on their stereotype rather than real people.
And often the judgment is, if you couldn't hold a man, there's something wrong with you. What did you do wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that you have to be in a relationship with a man to be and married to be a legitimate, functional
yes.
person. And it just boggles my mind. Thanks.
Okay.
Yes.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Lisa Dodson. She is a fellow with the Radcliffe Public Policy Institute and also teaches at Harvard. Her book, Don't Call Us Out of Name, The Untold Lives of Women and Girls in Poor America, published by the Beacon Press. It came out last fall. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. I want to talk about welfare reform. I think we have to acknowledge that what was accomplished under that heading was a change in a relatively small change, and there's still a lot of things that might pass for welfare that didn't change at all. But what we really were talking about in this case was the programs that were there to provide some sort of support for unmarried women, single women with kids.
Yeah.
And I think that some people particularly those, I guess, who thought that this was the right approach,
yeah.
point to the fact that welfare roles have declined, and so they'd say, well, see, it worked.
Yeah.
And the idea, although the basic thrust of it was simply just to say, it proceeds from the idea that says, if we don't push women off the welfare rolls, they'll stay forever. So what we're going to do is we're going to put limits on, we're going to require them to work.
Yeah.
And the idea is that basically we're going to push them out the door as quick as we possibly can.
Yes.
Given your experience, the people that you've talked to, what has been the practical result of welfare reform?
Well, I think that, I guess one thing I want to say is that about the notion of success, there's no question there's been a dramatic caseload decline all over the country, and in some places just phenomenal, like 90%.
Mm-hmm.
If that's success, then, you know, then yes, people are definitely leaving welfare. If, in fact, it turns out, and we don't really know as a nation, if it turns out that the circumstances these women and children end up in over the next, not 6 months, but really 6 years, because the ramifications keep on coming, if the circumstances they end up in are such that it is a kind of increased desperate, increased poverty, and increased all of the problems that we already know full well are correlated with poverty, ill health, evictions, severe childhood distresses that result in poor learning or poor opportunity to learn. The list goes on and on. If, in fact, all of those increase, certainly don't decrease the way it's been argued they will because people are employed, but in fact increase, then it seems to me there's two very large costs. One is ultimately it will actually cost more dollars than the modest amount of money people get on a monthly basis, have been getting on a monthly basis. It will dwarf the cost of medical care and all the other kinds of care that are associated with children who, or families who just unravel. So that's one issue I want to bring up in the notion of success of caseload decline. I think the other one I want to bring up is a sort of broader ethical, social issue, and that is, I mean, right now in this country, one-third of all our children live at or below 150% of poverty. 150% of poverty is about $250 a week. Almost all programs consider people living at 150% of poverty poor. In fact, you can get some public assistance if you're at 180% of poverty. So it's actually a fairly conservative measure. It's a third of American children. If, in fact, as a society, we're not prepared to do more than end welfare, if we're not, as a society, it's going to come up with all alternatives to welfare, alternative ways to invest in our people and particularly invest in our children, what we're talking about is one out of three of our adult people in this society being people who have had a tremendously different experience, a vast divide. They live in another America. And their attitude and their perspective on this nation and our democracy and who we are as a people will therefore be vastly different. And so I think that there's a tremendous future cost in how we treat our people, as well as an ethical cost. I think to speak to your very practical question, what do I see happening? Right now, I see happening what, I mean, the New York Times had an article I thought that spoke very well to this. It mirrors exactly what I'm seeing in doing my work, and that is families of very poor women and children are trying desperately to absorb as much as they can, and very often that means grandmothers. The New York Times reported that in New York City, the number of grandmothers who are picking up children because mothers simply can't get a job or can't find childcare, the number is just swelling. But the problem is many of these grandmothers are already working, and they themselves cannot take on. And so these are really going to end up being temporary arrangements. So what we see is families that are already fragile taking on more stress, and the ramifications of that won't happen in a month or 6 months, but it'll be more in 2 or 3 years. We already know that more children are being given up for foster care in some places, and we know that homelessness is certainly very much increased in the state of Massachusetts where I live. They're very tough cutoff policies, really quite aggressive, the rate of homeless families is increasing in the state. So these are the things that we'll see, and of course, eventually they cost us as a people. You know, what happens to big, big chunks of our people over there eventually happens to all of us.
We have a couple minutes left, 2-3 minutes left, and several callers, and I don't think we'll be able to get them all, but at least we'll see if we can do one or two. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting with Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Yes.
You asked a question that is often asked that I think is a very telling way of looking at the situation and maybe part of the problem. I don't recall exactly how you worded the question, but it's often asked something along the lines of, what causes young girls to get into this situation? Of course, that's so that we can address some of those problems. But as long as we don't ask what causes young boys and men to impregnate girls and walk away from the situation, because I assume the vast majority of these women are not mated with the biological father of their child.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think that if they were, we might have a different situation. It might be troublesome, but it might be significantly better. I suspect it would be. And we are not helping those young men who are making a choice that most of us in society feel is a mistake for them as well as their biological child, as well as the young girl or woman.
Yeah. You make a very good point. Most of the young men that are the fathers of the children that the young women I've talked to, are themselves people who do not have many economic resources. They're virtually in the same communities and facing the same situation. They're often somewhat older, but that's true with most couples. Sometimes they're a bit older. But there isn't a lot of resources, and unless we cultivate and unless we invest and support the development of boys as well as girls, the situation will not get better, for sure. This is not just about girls.
Well, I feel that very strongly, because
yes.
It's sort of like, why did these girls get in this situation anyway?
Yes.
Rather than hearing, why did these boys get in this situation?
Yes.
Because we don't see their situation because they walked away from it.
Yes.
And
well,
we as a society, I think, need to work on that. I'm not really sure how, but
yeah.
I need
yes.
to.
Well, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. My research happens to be about women and girls, so I tend to focus everything on that, but I usually always include that, it must be both. We're all a part of the society together, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. One more here, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, is that me?
Yes.
Well, I must say that I've forgotten your name, speaker. I hope you will forgive me.
Yes, my name's Lisa.
Well, Lisa, we read so frequently about people who are doing research on this and research on that, but I must say that you are one of the few researchers I have ever heard who sound as if you have your feet on the ground.
Thank you.
Instead of your head in the air,
yes.
And try this. And I really think you have a lot to contribute. Now, the big question,
yep.
Why doesn't Congress or whoever is deciding all of these welfare and ways we spend the taxes, why don't they interview people like you
mm-hmm.
instead of another politician?
Yeah.
Let's get on with it. I mean, it's very nice for the politicians to get elected and drive in a big car off to Washington. Nice for them.
Yeah.
What about all the battered people that are left in their wake? It's not right.
Yeah.
That's all.
We have, unfortunately, I can give you, Ms. Dodson, about a minute to respond to the caller because we're just about out of time. But please do.
Well, I want to say it's a wonderful question, and the reason I think I'm not very often asked to give my research and opinions is that I think I challenge the very basis of how the decisions are being made. To start with, I think that the women themselves, the people themselves, should be talking about these issues and should not be excluded. And finally, my issue is investing in all of our people, and I think many of the women I talk to feel the same way. And that doesn't seem to be the basis of the dialogue of most of the politicians.
Well, I'm sorry to have to rush you along, but I'm afraid we're just at the end of the time and we'll have to stop. And for people who would like to read more, again, the book that we have mentioned is titled Don't Call Us Out of Name, The Untold Lives of Women and Girls in Poor America, published by the Beacon Press. And our guest is Lisa Dodson. She is a fellow at the Radcliffe Public Policy Institute and also teaches at Harvard. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.